It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Eating, drinking, fiddling with the stereo, talking, texting with our cell phones while driving is something that kills thousands of people every year. I'm talking about distracted driving. Yes, we all do it. Some of the things that I've mentioned there while we're driving. This hour, we're going to talk about the latest research in distracted driving, but not only that, fatigue, the impact, what we're learning through science about fatigue, and cannabis as well. How is cannabis being high? How does that impact your driving? And then finally, toward the end of the hour, we'll talk about the latest update on autonomous vehicles. Did you know that the Eastern Iowa Corridor is one of 10 sites nationally that is doing a lot of research, was selected to do a lot of research on this? And we have a studio full of scientists with us studying in this area. It's so great to have Dan McGehee back. He's director of the University of Iowa's Transportation and Vehicle Safety Research Program, also adjunct professor of mechanical and industrial engineering, occupational health, and emergency medicine. Dan McGehee, welcome back to our program.
Thanks, Ben.
Tim Brown is with us as well, a research scientist at the National Advanced Driving Simulator, principal investigator of the group's cannabis research. Tim, welcome back.
Thank you, Ben.
Gary Milovitz is with us. Gary is a professor in the University of Iowa College of Pharmacy, clinical director of the National Advanced Driving Simulator cannabis work. Gary joins us by phone. Hi, Gary.
Thank you.
John Gasper is in our studio, research scientist and attention and distraction expert at the National Advanced Driving Simulator. Welcome to you all once again. If you'd like to join our conversation, I can't think of a better group to ask any driving question when it comes to how we drive safely or hazardously. You can look about it at the other way, the science of good driving. Also about automated cars. That'll be later in the hour. Have you been involved in any crashes or close calls that involve distracted driving? Tell us about your experience. I know I have. Perhaps I'll share that a little bit later. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Once again, 1-866-780-9100. Tim and Gary, let's start with you, cannabis and driving. We've known, of course, for a long time that alcohol impairs our ability to drive. There's been a lot of research on that, less so on marijuana. Some of the research now being done on how cannabis being high affects driving is being done at the University of Iowa's National Advanced Driving Simulator. Tim, start us off. What is a summary of the findings that we have so far about the impact of driving high?
Very good question. You brought up the alcohol aspect, and everyone's kind of got an idea of what impaired driving is from an alcohol standpoint. But when we talk about cannabis, it acts on the body differently than does alcohol. And my colleagues at the College of Pharmacy, College of Medicine can talk a little bit more about that from an internal standpoint. But what we know from the research that we've done is that period after they've consumed cannabis, and unlike alcohol, which has a long period of time where there's impairment, cannabis, it really peaks very quickly. And so your impairment happens almost immediately and then trails off over a shorter period of time. We've done a couple studies that have looked at that here at the University of Iowa, one of which is focused on cannabis in combination with low levels of alcohol. And that has really focused in that period of time immediately after you've consumed cannabis. And then we've done another study that looks at it a little bit further out, kind of an hour, 2 hours out from having consumed cannabis. And we're also, with that study, looking at EEG. So we're looking at what's going on in the brain at the same time that you're involved in driving and under the influence of cannabis. And so as we look at that near term, what we see is that we see things we would generally expect to see. We see more variability in lane keeping, so they're more likely to drift around in the lane, less precise control of the vehicle. We've also seen some attempts at compensation. We see lower speeds, so drivers may be aware that they're not quite as responsive as they would like to be, and so they slow down a little bit more, and so we see lower speeds relative to the speed limit for those drivers. As we compare it to kind of low levels of alcohol, we don't see as much drifting out of the lane as we do with low levels of alcohol. So mm-hmm. even below the legal limit with alcohol, we see some impairment and we see people's performance degraded. And with cannabis, comparing that to that low level of alcohol, we don't see quite as much in terms of drifting out of the lane We're still looking at some of the data to look at what the EEG data tells us about what's going on with the brain. We're also looking right now at how does the driver respond to things like pedestrians and unexpected changes in the environment. And so we're working with the College of Public Health and on reviewing that data right now. And those results will be available here in the next couple of months as we finish up that analysis.
Gary Milovets at the UI College of Pharmacy. Tell us, as far as our perceptions, what's happening in the brain when we talk about cannabis compared to alcohol, let's say here, how does that change our perceptions and our ability to drive? How does it impair us?
Well, I think the major thing we learned is that there is impairment from cannabis, but it's a different one than alcohol, like Tim was saying. What we think we're seeing is a change in the perception of time. And so, as Tim indicated, people drive slower. They seem to react a little bit slower. So something that might be a pressing thing is not perceived. An important thing happening very immediately may not be perceived with the rapidity that's necessary.
Mm-hmm. And how does that play how does that play itself out when you have something unexpected happen when you're driving and have to react to it?
Well, you probably wouldn't react as you normally would. So instead of maybe slamming on the brakes, if you saw something cross your path, you would apply it either with less pressure or maybe not apply it as quickly as you need to.
Mm-hmm. But that's the case in alcohol as well. You have a delayed response to hit the brakes, right?
Generally, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Tim?
Yeah, and I think one of the examples that we look at with that is, you know, as we kind of prep for the study, you know, one of the things we looked at is where we've got evidence of things that are going on with cannabis and what we might want to study to try and figure out what the effects are. And one of the things that sticks to my mind is one of the examples that came up of a crash involved with somebody with cannabis was in a large city where they were driving down the road. Somebody crossed in front of them. They dropped something. The pedestrian dropped something and bent down to pick it up, and the driver didn't respond to the fact that the driver the pedestrian had stopped on the road in front of them and just ran them over without responding at all. Mm-hmm. And so that points to that lack of response. If things are unexpected, it's harder to respond.
Can someone say unequivocally that being impaired with alcohol and or being impaired with cannabis is one is worse than the other when it comes to being a hazard on the road?
I think that they're different, and you know, there's more research that needs to be done to try and better understand all the different circumstances. You know, we focused very narrowly on kind of the acute administration of cannabis to people who are relatively less frequent users. But as we look at people who maybe are from a state where there's medical marijuana and they're using it on a daily basis, that needs to be examined more. People who use it more frequently, it also needs to be examined. Gary and I are currently partnered with some of our colleagues in Colorado who will be doing a study looking at medical marijuana and more frequent users and what the impact on them is using one of our driving simulators, which we'll take out there to Colorado for that study.
Mm-hmm. Gary, tell us a little bit about that because we have different components, a lot of components in cannabis. We have THC, CBD. It's the THC that makes people high. These other things can be helpful for, as medical marijuana, for epilepsy, for instance. So are you taking that into account in this research?
Yeah, I'm going to kind of...
It's difficult, huh?
Yeah, it's a hard question to answer. I can give you a little bit of background information. The cannabis plants that are commonly used as medicinal agents make something like 50 different cannabinoids, which is sort of the chemical group name for all the different types of active ingredients are in there. The ones that seem to have the most activity are the ones you mentioned, THC, or chemically it's delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol, and that's the one that causes the perception of highness or enjoyment, whatever, euphoria, whatever you want to call it. There are other cannabinoids, like you mentioned, cannabidiol, cannabinol, that seem to have other therapeutic effects. However, they have not well been studied and not been studied well in a real scientific manner. So much of that information is based on anecdotal or individual patients. There does seem to be a pattern there, like you said, for treatment of epilepsy and perhaps some other medical disorders.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the issues is that there are so many that there may be some interaction between different types of cannabinoids that are in the plants that create better therapeutic effects versus other combinations of that of those cannabinoids.
Tell us a little bit of how this research is done, because Iowa is not a state that is okay with recreational use of marijuana. How do you do that, or do you have to travel to Washington State or Colorado or elsewhere, Tim?
We do it very carefully. There are a lot of hoops to jump through, and so as with any research that's done here at the University of Iowa, the research is approved by the Institutional Review Board. So the Human Subjects Office reviews it. We've also got to work through the DEA to get the appropriate licenses. And so cannabis is a Schedule I drug. And so you can prescribe it under very narrow circumstances. So one of our colleagues has a Schedule I license, and he prescribes the cannabis for the purposes of the research. And so there are a lot of steps that we go through. And even to the point where we try and control the administration of the cannabis. And so rather than it being smoked as a cigarette, we use a vaporization process so that we can control the amount of plant material that's there mm-hmm. and how much actually gets absorbed into the system to try and maintain some levels that are consistent from one subject to the next.
Is it as easy to measure as alcohol? We have a blood alcohol level permitted up to 0.08 in Iowa. Can it be measured that exactly? Would we have that in the future? Let's say we have more recreational use of marijuana in the country.
That is one of the major challenges as we look at cannabis impairment, is that, you know, we can get very accurate measurements by taking a blood sample, but that's not a timely task. Right now, there's a lot of different groups that are working on oral fluid sampling methods where you can take a swab from your cheek to estimate what the level of THC is. They're still working through those issues because there's a lot of complications with that in terms of even just some of the complications with smoking cannabis, which is it may cause dry mouth, which means it's harder to collect the saliva, so you can't get a good estimate because you can't collect enough saliva. There's not really a breathalyzer version of it. There's some folks that are trying to do that, and Gary might speak to that, but it's the way that cannabis is processed, it doesn't really eliminate through the breath the mm-hmm. same way that alcohol does.
Mm-hmm. You want to add to that, Gary?
No, Tim summed it up very well.
Okay. So Gary, let me ask you, looking forward, what are some big questions in this area, cannabis and driving, that we need answers to as soon as possible?
With our one study, we generated a number of questions. Some of the things that are not well understood are, as Tim indicated earlier, we looked at folks that were occasional users, and we'd be interested in knowing what happens with someone that takes cannabis or uses cannabis on a consistent basis. Do they metabolize it the same? Does it cause the same types of effects? You're probably aware some medications can be taken for a chronic period of time, and whatever side effects that occur with them, we get tolerance to. And so we don't know if that's what's happening with cannabis or not. The other things that are maybe a bit more esoteric are there differences between men and women and how it's absorbed and how it's metabolized and how does that then influence their levels and their abilities behind the wheel of a car.
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us, we're talking about some of the latest research on what impairs us while we're driving. Gary Milovets is with us, the University of Iowa College of Pharmacy, clinical director of the National Advanced Driving Simulator, their cannabis work. Tim Brown with us as well, research scientist at that same simulator. And Dan McGeehee, John Gasper with us. We'll talk with them in just a moment. If you'd like to join us, we're going to be talking about distracted driving here in a minute. If you'd like to join us, perhaps you've been involved in a crash or a close call that involved distracted driving. Tell us about your experience, 1-866-780-9100. Well, I wanted to start off talking about distracted driving by, of course, you know, Dan, distracted driving is anything, what, anything that we're doing in our car as a driver that keeps our attention off our driving.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So anytime our attention moves away from that forward roadway is when we lose focus of what's happening ahead of us. And today we have many different kinds of things in the car that can draw that attention away.
Mm-hmm. And I see if you're driving 55 miles an hour, you take your eyes off the road for 5 seconds to do a text or mess with your navigation system, how far do you go?
Yeah, I mean, 60 miles an hour is, 88 feet per second, so you can drive the length of Kinnick pretty quickly in
blind.
Just that quick of a look away.
Okay. I wanted to share a story here that one of our listeners, Christy Castenson, shared on this program a few months ago. She lost her mother-in-law and her husband in a distracted driving accident near Dayton, Iowa, and was a guest on our Legislative Day program just a while ago. Let's listen back to a part of my conversation with her. And in this part, I started by asking her to explain what happened.
Yes, on May 8th, 2015, my husband was taking his mom to the doctor's, and a man went through a stop sign off gravel and was texting and hit my husband's side and killed him. And then his mother passed away shortly thereafter.
This was a 21-year-old driver, Colton Bills. What were the consequences for the driver in this case?
The consequences was he's on probation for 4 years now. He was charged in January 9th of 2 counts of vehicular homicide. But when the sentencing came, they just gave him 4 years of probation.
Mm-hmm.
And a stop sign violation, and that was it.
Can you give us a sense in a few sentences what it's been like for you after this crash that killed your husband, your mother-in-law due to a distracted driver, a texting driver? How has your life changed? How have you coped?
Basically day to day. You put one foot in front of the other. I lost my partner. We were married 28 years. My kids lost their dad. I became a single parent overnight and just trying to get by, learning things that I, with the house, with the farm, stuff that I never knew because he took care of everything. Mm. So it's just starting over at my age of learning how to do everything, and it's been very, very hard.
I'm sure it has.
And for my kids, too. Mm-hmm. My kids lost their best friend. My husband was full of spirit, and he'd always, keep everything light and happy, and my kids just don't have a dad anymore.
Christy, what are your thoughts when you drive around, you see people texting and driving? It's commonplace now, isn't it?
Right, very, yes, and it gets very, when I see that, I get very upset. I also get upset when I see people just roll through stop signs. Our lives changed in a split second, and people have to start realizing that they're going to hurt someone else or themselves, and their lives are more important than a text message. You can pull over. No message is that important that you need it right now. We used to be fine without cell phones, and I think it's become such a habit for people that they have to have it in their hand, and we need to go back to just putting it away until you're stopped or pulled over. No message is that important.
Part of my conversation with Christy Castenson on this program a few weeks ago, or as you heard there, her mother-in-law, her husband, killed by a distracted driver who was texting. Dan McGehee, I just learned from you, you testified during this trial, didn't you?
Yes, this is one of the first trials in the state of Iowa that looked at distracted driving as a causal, the main cause of two fatalities in this case.
Mm-hmm. When we look at distracted driving, I want to get to the research here, but perhaps this is for Dan here. When we look at distracted driving, we are choosing to do something that impairs our driving. In that way, it is a parallel to drinking alcohol and getting behind the wheel. Do we see it the same way, or do we have to grow a little bit there in our mindset, in our awareness?
Yeah, I mean, it's different in relative to alcohol in the sense that alcohol is sort of a sustained impairment, whereas when you choose to send a text message or read a message, your eyes go off of the road for that period of time, which spikes that impairment immediately, where you're losing track of information around you, like stop signs and cars around you, pedestrians and so forth. So it's really that spike in distraction that is actually much worse than alcohol in many cases, mm-hmm. whereas alcohol is sort of a sustained impairment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. John Gasper, let's talk a little bit about the research you've done as a research scientist in attention and distraction at the National Advanced Driving Simulator. What are you looking at specifically with your research?
Well, I think we've known about distraction being a problem for a long time. I think from a basic psychological perspective, we know that people are really bad at trying to divide their attention among multiple tasks. As Dan mentioned, as soon as you move kind of that spotlight of attention away, you see what we typically refer to as inattentional blindness. So the example of missing the stop sign is a really good one. You can be even looking at something, but if your attention's somewhere else, completely miss that information. So lately we've been doing some research to look at different interventions, different ways to detect when someone might be distracted or other types of impairment like drowsiness.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm wondering, we are at the beginning of a new era since cell phones have become smartphones. We're doing more and more with them. We have navigation systems in our cars now too. I mean, this is a very, to put it coldly, I guess, a very interesting time to be studying this, because we're distracting ourselves behind the wheel more and more, and we have to be careful about how we proceed, John.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think the complexity of the distractions that we're engaging in are much greater than they used to be. It used to be either visual or completely cognitive, and now we're kind of getting this in-between area where you have some of these voice systems that require some cognitive attention, some visual attention, and people are kind of switching back and forth and performing these really quite complex tasks in the context of driving.
And similar to alcohol, we can become quite easily overconfident with the degree to which we can multitask.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if you ask people, everyone's better than the average driver.
Right. I can text while I'm driving. I can do this, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but if you look at the research, you find that very few people are able to do multiple things at one time. And probably no one is capable of doing two very complex tasks at the same time.
Okay, we'll be back in just a moment. We're going to talk more about the science of driving impairment, I guess we could call that. Here's a statistic. In 2015 alone, almost 3,500 people were killed, almost 400,000 injured in motor vehicle crashes involving distracted drivers. We'll talk more about distracted driving when we come back. Perhaps you have a crash to relay in your experience or a close call. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. We'll talk about the latest on fatigue and driving when we come back. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today we're talking about what impairs us in terms of driving, and several scientists with us this hour talking about different facets. Tim Brown is with us, Gary Milovets, John Gasper, and Dan McGehee, who is director of the National Advanced Driving Simulator, all the others working in conjunction with their different aspects there. If you'd like to join us, if you've been involved in any crashes or close calls that involve distracted driving, tell us about your experience. 1-866-780-9100. A little later in the program, we'll get an update from Dan about the autonomous vehicle research right here in the Eastern Iowa Corridor area. Wendy is on the phone. Wendy joins us from Marion. You've been listening to our discussion. Wendy, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
What do you have to share?
Well, I just have to share a situation, not that I was in the accident, but I am from Marion, where we had a situation where there was a family, a mother and her four children. She had picked them up from school and was on her way home, and she was on a two-lane highway, 55-mile-an-hour two-lane highway, and their vehicle was stopped to take a left turn. And from behind, there was a gentleman who was texting on his phone and ran into the back of their vehicle and ended up taking the life of two of her daughters, seriously injuring another one to a point where she still is recovering
at this time, and the mother obviously has some very emotional and physical problems. Luckily, the smallest child was not very much injured physically. I know that I had even done things where I had been on the phone and done some very small little things that at that point, that's when it hit me that I would not use my phone anymore while I was in my vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And, but it just amazes me that we have to get to that point. Even I saying that I had to do that. I had to get to that point. It had to be that close to home before I just said, this is ridiculous. Nothing's worth it.
Right, right.
So I wonder what the, if any of the people have any ideas of how soon does it start? Do we need to start before kids get their licenses where they have to go to some of these simulators and prove to them that they can't do it?
Mm-hmm. Let's go to John Gasper here, looking at distraction and attention in driving and his research. Wendy, thanks for your story. That's really an impressive story of change, and interesting that it has to be sort of next door. We can't just hear statistics of thousands of people being killed per year because of distracted driving. If it's someone in Marion, in this case, a family, that impacts us in a greater way. John Gasper, interesting story there. What about her question?
Yeah, I think this touches on some really good points. I think one of the problems with distraction, and probably the reason we see so many people out there distracted who think they're able to do it, is that we rarely get feedback that anything bad's going to happen. So you can think of these crashes as kind of the combination of a bad activity and the wrong place, wrong time sort of situation. But what's helpful oftentimes to kind of promote this change is to give people some kind of experience of what it's actually like to be distracted, how much information you miss. I know Tim and Dan have some experience kind of with this sort of feedback, and I believe Dan can probably speak to this more, that providing that early feedback is beneficial mm-hmm. for younger drivers.
Is this built into to younger drivers, driver's ed these days?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about one of the big challenges is that we're really plugged in from the time we're really small children now. We're riding around in the backseat of our cars with a screen in front of us all the time. So our attention has to be occupied, and we learn that from the very early parts of being inside a car. Whereas the generations of yesterday had to be bored and look around and sort of take
and sing
in,
songs.
And take in the driving environment. But there's this compulsion now that we need something to divert our attention, because driving is, you know, largely sort of a boring task. So it's really about sort of educating people about the behavior elements of this. Certainly, you know, you can teach people over and over again, but as John said earlier, we all think that we can do it better than others, and the other guy is the bad driver. The other guy can't do that while he drives, and I can.
Mm-hmm. We're coming to the end of a legislative session here. I know distracted driving has been something that has been debated in Des Moines at the State House. John, what can you say about the degree to which the science we have about distracted driving is being taken up, paid attention to by our lawmakers, and coming up with better laws so fewer are injured and killed?
Sure. So it seems still kind of a fluid situation, but I think what it seems like is that texting is going to be kind of labeled as a primary offense, so you can be pulled over and receive a fine for texting, but using the phone in other ways like GPS or making calls is still going to be permitted. Handheld phones are still permitted here in Iowa.
And this is a little bit of a difficulty from a law enforcement perspective, right? Because for law enforcement, Dan, it's easy to see if someone's using their phone, but not easy to see how they're using their phone.
Yeah, exactly. I think this is really where law enforcement is speaking up pretty loudly. In fact, Governor Brandt said himself, suggested early on in the session that there really just be a hands-free bill, because law enforcement, you know, if they see somebody, you know, with their face, you know, into their phone, they don't know what they're texting, if they're Snapchatting, if they're on Facebook, if they're sending an email. So the current texting language is quite difficult to ascertain out in the field.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about, I know, John, you also do some work in researching drowsiness. Now, that's certainly something that's been around for since as long as there have been cars. What is what is new at the driving simulator in this area?
So we've been, the last few years, spending quite a bit of time devoted to trying to understand drowsiness, both from how it affects performance up to how we might detect it, and then once we were able to detect it, what we might be able to do about it. As you said, Ben, it's been around for a very long time since people have been driving, but we still don't really have a good grasp of how many drowsy drivers are out there and how many crashes are due primarily to drowsy driving.
Mm-hmm.
Some of our research that Tim and Chris Schwartz are leading has been to kind of try to quantify better how many drowsy drivers are out there, understand how big the problem is. We're also doing some work to look at in-vehicle technology, things like cameras and other sensors that can detect when someone is drowsy or impaired from distraction or alcohol. Mm. And then the most recent work that we're doing is to look at countermeasures. So when we detect that someone's drowsy using those technologies, how do we actually get them to pull over and take a nap?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Are we very good, John, at judging whether we're too sleepy to drive?
We're pretty good at understanding when we're sleepy. The problem is, much like distraction in some sense, we feel like we can kind of push through it. So if you've ever been on a long trip and kind of had that feeling of, you know, you're falling asleep, maybe you're nodding your head a little bit, but you still want to push through those last couple hours to just make it home. That's kind of a common situation that we're interested in understanding.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Scott from Des Moines called. He couldn't stay on the line, but it's interesting. He's a school bus driver. He's concerned that we're teaching our children to be distracted and attached to technology as passengers in the car. Scott says, as a school bus driver, that the children are so attached to their screens on the bus, they won't even pay attention to his announcements as a driver. Now, I used to be a school bus driver. I don't know if anybody paid attention to my announcements. That was before cell phones. But an interesting point there, Scott, in Des Moines here. Let's jump into the last little facet we wanted to talk about, automated driving. Dan, as director of the National Driving Simulator here, you are working with autonomous vehicles and watching, tracking their steady advancement of these self-driving vehicles. Tell us, first of all, about this testing site in eastern Iowa, the corridor, and how unique it is in the country.
Yeah, so I think this is a good transition to go from what we're talking about largely is a driver error phenomenon. So we know that about 94% of car crashes have some element of driver error. So the technologies that lead into more automated vehicles and driver assistance systems more specifically are really helping. We're starting to see very strong data from the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety to show that we can now avoid crashes or minimize their severity. So one of the things that just occurred about 2 months ago is that we were designated as one of 10 sites in the United States for an automated vehicle proving ground. And that, 64 places around the country applied for this program, and we partnered with the Iowa City Area Development Group with Mark Nolte and Tom Banta. We have a great relationships with the economic development folks, not only here in Iowa City, but across the state with Debbie Durham and others at the state level. Put in an application, and out of those 64, we were selected as one of 10 sites around the country. We just recently, 2 weeks ago, had the kickoff meeting in Ann Arbor.
Mm-hmm. So what does that mean? Does that mean in terms of research funding or just projects are directed your way? What does it actually in practical terms mean?
So the United States Department of Transportation was looking for a way to sort of filter out all of the places that were raising their hands to say, hey, we're open for business. So they were looking for places that had a longer history of doing this kind of research and the kinds of infrastructure and relationships with we have with the Iowa Department of Transportation. So a good relationship with the cities and the counties and the state was really essential for this, being able to attract high-tech business and showing a history of doing that. And at the University of Iowa, we're just about on our 25th year of doing advanced vehicle safety research in these areas where we have literally all of the systems that are in your car, whether it be forward collision warning systems, adaptive cruise control, lane keeping. All of those technologies actually came through the University of Iowa as part of the government testing sequence. So We have our fingerprints on many of those technologies, so it's really exciting to be able to take this to the next level and begin to bring some of these vehicles. We have two vehicles in the next year. These are not robots that drive on the road. These are driver assistance systems that sort of support the driver and that can step in at the last moment and correct their lane position or put on the brakes before they rear end a car.
But so does it actually take control if you're coming too close to a car? Will the brakes be applied without you touching the brake paddle?
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. So when we start to get into stop-and-go traffic in Des Moines or Cedar Rapids during rush hour, that's where we see a lot of property damage, rear-end collisions. These cars that are available today, and I should add, very inexpensively, cars like the Toyota Corolla, the Honda Civic, the Chevy Cruze, the Ford Focus, all have these automatic emergency braking systems for on the very entry-level cars that cost, you know, $19,000, $20,000, $21,000. These technologies are in the 2017 model year. So it's really exciting to be able to see these kinds of technologies coming on board very quickly. And this is where we've developed the website mycardoeswhat.org to really help communicate all of these technologies that are coming into cars today.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about a mobile app that's from the National Safety Council in the University of Iowa. If you want to get on your smartphone, if you want to get it safely on your smartphone, not behind the wheel, a tour of the new vehicle technologies, what will you experience through that app?
Yeah, so we have a new virtual reality app that you can literally plug your smartphone into. And if you get a hold of us at the National Advanced Driving Simulator, we'll I'll let you know where you can get a hold of those. You essentially clip your phone into there, into this little set of goggles, and you can sort of take a tour of the inside of your car and actually observe how some of these technologies work. So it's kind of a new medium for us to sort of bring everybody into the virtual world, which is exciting because we all work at the National Advanced Driving Simulator in that virtual environment. So this is a way we can bring this to you in your home.
Mm-hmm. How do people find that app?
You can go to mycardoeswhat.org and Google that, and you'll run across that program.
Okay. We have all this new technology. Of course, this technology has to interact with us, humans. What testing is that? What questions are out there? How are we doing as far as getting drivers to adopt this new technology? One of the first things, and we've talked about it before, is I don't know if I trust this technology to stop or to alert me to that. You know, I feel safer when I'm in human hands.
Yeah, that's precisely right. In fact, we've just completed a study just looking at that. If you ask people, you know, would you trust a car that would brake on its own? Most people say, oh, no way. But then when you take them out into that car and you've demonstrated in traffic, they go, wow, this is actually pretty cool. And and even lane keeping. So you can be on Interstate 80, trundling across the state, as we do frequently to Des Moines. And if you drift out of your lane, it will just subtly correct your position. Again, if you ask people, would you trust a car to do that? They say no until they actually experience it. And that's one of the challenges with a lot of technologies. Starting 25 years ago, I looked at what people thought about GPS navigation systems, and they said, oh, no way would I ever get rid of my paper map. That's pretty silly. And now it's like people can't read a map to save their life.
No.
So,
no.
So technology takes a long time to come into our frame of reference and to sort of rely on it. And I see the same thing happening with these driver assistance technologies and higher levels of automation. Once you experience them, people will kind of understand how they work and how they don't work and adapt their driving from there.
Mm-hmm. As more and more technologies, semi-autonomous technologies enter our vehicle, help us drive, what are the chief legal questions that you see arising as this happens? I mean, we can imagine scenarios where, you know, you're letting your vehicle do most of the work and somehow there's an accident there and then there's a dispute. How do you handle that when you were not in full control of your car, to just say it that way?
Well, today, and that's really how we look at things, is you are still fully in control. And even under at least the production levels of driver assistance systems, you are fully in control. And this is really one of the questions is when we get into these transition areas, like there's a project in Sweden right now in Gothenburg called Drive Me. And this is where, imagine you're commuting to Cedar Rapids. Once you get onto that highway, you can literally press a button and the car will be under full automated control. Mm-hmm. So highway driving is likely to be where we see some of the first fully automated driving. It won't be in downtown Iowa City or driving out to your house in a neighborhood. But the highway is generally more limited access. Mm-hmm. So once you turn over everything to the car, there's an expectation that it will do all of the responding in an emergency. So the legal issues right now are more tied to the driver still monitoring the automation, which has some problems with it, is because we're not really good at monitoring automation. So down the road, you know, the car companies and the computer companies that are doing this will have to take ownership of crashes. But we have, again, we have to realize that when 94% of crashes have some element of driver error, it's a pretty low bar. So we're able to prevent many crashes in this next generation of technologies that's coming out on the everyday car.
Mm-hmm. Let us look into the future in the last two or three minutes we have here, Dan, here. Okay, I'm going to give you just a picture of what I see here, and you tell me how far it is away. Cruising down a, I don't know, 380 or 80 here in Iowa, something like that, and I look around at the other cars. I'm not behind. I'm not doing anything with the driver. I actually swiveled my my seat around so I can play. Let's pick a really old game, Parcheesi, with the other riders in my car. I look around and, you know, there are convoys of trucks and nobody's got their hands on the wheels, and everything's just marvelous out there. And there are a few old folk out there who are clutching their wheels amidst all of these automated cars going in and out. How far are we away from that, or is that just a really bad vision that Ben dreamt up?
Yeah, I think it's really hard to tell that future. I think that we'll certainly see some highway automation in the next few years out there. But in terms of when we all have that technology, it literally takes, you know, 30 years to recycle all of our cars. So if we dial forward to 2047 start date, we'll put that into your diary, Ben.
Okay.
We'll see if that's the reality, but we have a long ways to go.
Write that down. 2047. It was set in 2017. Okay. 30 years from now. All right. I got you.
But I think we still have a lot of challenges. As we've seen with some of the crashes that have occurred with Tesla, with Google, you know, one crash, whether it's a minor crash with Google, is international news. And certainly a single fatality in a Tesla is international news. And the National Transportation Safety Board, who studies plane crashes and train crashes, has also weighed in and has a group that's studying automated vehicle crashes, more highly automated vehicles. So mm-hmm. we'll see from the National Transportation Safety Board what their report on the Tesla crash in Florida, what that says, and whether there will be changes in production technologies.
Mm-hmm. Well, when technology is part of the reason for a crash or the reason for a crash, what can we say? What is the oversight? What was the problem here? What didn't we see?
Well, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration handles defects for the federal government, and that's their job as the chief regulatory agency. And they've already come and look at the crash of this Tesla, and they found that there was no defect among the technologies. That's not to say that there was an issue that they chose to not determine. They found that there was not a defect in the systems. The National Transportation Safety Board is sort of another federal body who comes and looks at these things independently that really tries to look at the root causation of the crash.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we've come to the end of a fascinating hour, catching us up on some of the latest research on impaired driving and also, as we just heard, the advancement of semi-autonomous and autonomous self-driving cars. Dan McGeehee is a director of the National Advanced Driving Simulator, and Tim Brown has been with us as well. We want to thank Tim, research scientist at that simulator as well, Carrie Milovitz, professor at the University of Iowa College of Pharmacy,
doing cannabis work at the driving simulator. John Gasper, research scientist with the attention and distraction a facet of research at the driving simulator going on. John, Gary, Tim, and Dan, thank you so much for a fascinating hour.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Coming up tomorrow on the program, we'll look at politics. President Trump facing his most critical week of statesmanship so far. We hope you'll join us. Wayne Moyer and Jim McCormick will be with us, our political analysts, politics at home and abroad, tomorrow, next time on River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.